This week on the Drag Scene Podcast, we talk with the first man to the 350s on a radio tire, Kevin Rivenbark. We also talk with Jeff Turk, the first person to crack into the 7 second range in the factory showdown class. So pull those belts tight, get ready to put in the beams. The Drag Scene Podcast starts now. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of the Drag Scene Podcast. I'm your host, Senior Associate Editor Brian Wagner, and boy, oh boy, do we have a show for you this week. We get to talk with two of the most interesting people in the drag racing world, Kevin Rivenbark, who picked up the $101,000 at the Sweet 16 and hit the first 350 radial pass out of the park at the event. We also get to talk with Jeff Turk, who kind of was the catalyst for really setting off this factory showdown, factory supercar craze of 7 second passes last year. We get his insight to where he thinks the class is going now. So without further ado, let's get this drag racing party started. All right, my next guest on the Drag Scene Podcast is Mr. 7 second, the man that made it a trend before it was a trend in the factory showdown trim, Mr. Jeff Turk. What's up, Jeff?
Man, it's another day in paradise, and hey, just thank you for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to the folks about what's going on with this class. Very exciting stuff.
Yeah, no problem, man. I mean, it's really cool to see, you know, factory stock, factory showdown, whatever, you know, NMCA, NHRA, what you want to call it, kind of how all this is coming about. And I remember the first time I saw your car at Joliet, I was like, man, that's a sharp ride. No idea, you know, what was in store, and then all of a sudden you start seeing more about the car and what it was doing and what records you were setting. It was like, man, this dude's gonna do it. He's gonna be the first guy to break that barrier. You know, what was it like when you were first trying to do that in a drag pack, nonetheless? You know, at the time, everybody wrote those off for dead. Literally, it was just like, oh, you know, it's Copos or Cobra Jets, and all of a sudden here comes this wild man from the Midwest in a drag pack smacking everybody around. You know, what was that like?
Well, I mean, you know, I brought the car out and I was just going to run it in super stock and stock. I don't know when you saw it in Joliet, but I was running it in super stock actually. And that was my intent. I had run the super stock Hemis, the 68 Hemi cars, for a short stint in my life and learned that, you know, there are some mountains that are pretty expensive to climb and you just keep falling off and having to reclimb every day. And I didn't necessarily know I wanted to do that again. So we were planning on running super stock. And as we ran in the super stock ranks, we were out running some of the showdown cars with more weight in the car. And the Mopar guys came to me and said, wouldn't you consider running this in the showdown stuff? Actually, Dale Aldo was the one that suggested that to me at the U.S. Nationals. And I said, yeah, I mean, I'll give it a go. So that's kind of how it started. And it did quite, to be honest, if I'm really honest about the motivation, it was a lot of guys coming up and saying exactly what you said. These drag packs have no chance. They're too big. They're too heavy. It's a shame you guys can't really compete with the Mustangs and with Copos. And I had several people who are very close to me in my life tell me I couldn't do it. So, you know, usually what that means for me is I'm going to go try. So that's kind of what happened.
Yeah, it's usually like when my wife tells me something's a bad idea due to the racing exactly. Stuff. I'm like, all right, that means it's a good idea.
Exactly. And I'm sitting in front of my little brother, Mike Roth, who builds a lot of these factory showdown cars. And he, in fact, told me at the 2016 U.S. Nationals, after the Mopar guy said, hey, why don't you run this factory showdown? I went over to him and said to him, hey, I'm thinking about maybe just instead of building a super stock motor, I talked to Tony, maybe we just build a factory showdown motor and go out and try that. He said, don't even try, Turk. You'll never outrun Barton, ever. So he's going to hate it that I said that. And he'll correct me if he was online with me right now and say, I didn't say that. I said it's a dumb idea. You're going to spend all kinds of money and time. And it got his edit to it now. But the truth is, that kind of lit me up. And lots of guys come to me in staging lane saying these Mopars just can't keep up. So with that and with a little bit of chip on our shoulder, Tony Bischoff, myself, working with Jason Cohn, and then of course Mike Roth jumped in on the fray as soon as we decided we're going to go do it, and we all kind of put our heads together and said, we ought to be able to do this. We ought to be able to at least run with these guys. So we tried, and the rest is kind of history. It was a great ride running those cars.
Yeah, I mean, it was awesome to see how all that was going down and hearing the stories about people sprinting to the staging lanes to see if they could be the first to lay down the 7 second pass. I mean, it was like a really cool, almost like nostalgia feel, you know, the old days of stock and super stock with what you guys were doing there.
Yeah, it was crazy. Towards the end there at 17, when we, we'd gotten things ironed out, and I'd been working on Leah's car with the SRT guys, and we got it running good there for the last couple events of 17. I went out towards the end and ran the Fall Classic and won an 802, and we couldn't just quite get it down on an 802, and then the weather kind of got bad later that day. Unusual for a Fall Classic, it warmed up. So then we went down the race to St. Louis, the division race down there, to close out the year, and had issues and couldn't get the thing to hook. And then we got it all fixed up and took it down to Louisiana to no problem for the last race of the year in November to try to be the first guy in the sevens. And we tried 13 times to get down the track. And I think in those 13 quarter mile passes, I probably covered about a half mile every pass. using all the lane and just fighting it all the way down, and we got like an 8-12 out of it on that track down there, and we just could not get it done. So we left 17 without being the first in the sevens, which turned out to be really beneficial, because then the Holley guys, fantastic Holley EFI guys, did the Holley EFI 7 second club, and they paid 10, well, $5,000 to win to do it if you did it the first time, and if you did it with their Holley EFI, which I had and was big time part of making this happen, you got $10,000. So then we went down to Bradenton and really didn't expect, given a lot of things going on in my personal life and with my family, I didn't expect to be there and didn't expect to have a shot at it, because we hadn't done any testing. The car was pretty much the way it was when I took it down to Louisiana and couldn't get it down the track. We just loaded it in the trailer, last minute jumped in the truck, took it to Bradenton, and in the second pass down the track, it went 797, and that didn't count because that was in kind of the night before time trials. And the next pass, I ran behind, they took you out in pairs based upon your points, and I hadn't run much in MCA racing, so I wasn't that high in points. And I watched three pairs go down in front of me, and I watched Barton go down in front of me, and he went like an 802, 803. I went down and thought, hey, it was a good pass, didn't feel that spectacular, probably was an 802 like Barton. And about that time, Ted Hughes comes walking up, shoves his hand in the window, and goes, "Congratulations!" I said, "For what? For running that 802 last year?" He said, "No, for being the first guy in the sevens. I was right beside you, and I looked up the clocks, and you went 799." I said, "No, I didn't." And Barton came walking up, and he said, "What'd you run?" I said, "He's saying I ran a 799." He says, "Oh, that's bullshit." I said, "Well, I'm not the guy that said it. He's the guy that said it. I haven't seen the ticket yet." And so probably the world knew a half hour before I did, as the story goes. But anyway, it was a great day down there in Florida, and then we went on to runner up in that race and lost in an all Mopar final. So I think we kind of vindicated the drag bags are for real.
Oh yeah, I mean that whole scenario, and that went down, and I remember when it got out on social media, you went that 797, those that followed the class were like, all right, it's about to get real down there. If he can back that up in competition, people's heads are going to explode. And you went out there and then did it. It seemed like that, before the class was hot, but it just seemed like that was kind of like the point, that the line of demarcation for that class, when it just grabbed everybody's attention and they're like, all right, we really need to watch this because cool stuff's happening. And it's escalated quickly from there, to say the least, right?
Yeah, it has. And I think all throughout last year, I think people saw the potential in the class, and I think people realized the level of work it took to be competitive. I mean, I'm kind of a one-man show. I mean, I get lots of help, fantastic help from VES Racing Engines and Tony Bischoff and his whole crew. I mean, just, right there with me the whole way at the, building engines, and I work with them. I go test engines and run engines and work on the engine program with them. But, they're just every bit as part of the team as anybody else. Mike Roth, who built the car, great chassis guy. Jason Cohen, I mean. But at the track, I often go by myself. So, you can see the level of professionalism coming in with all these teams that show up with four or five guys. I was up there on the starting line when I'm helping Carl Task out, or Randy Eakins, my partners this year. I always give them the hard guy time, these guys, about how many radio sets they have to have. And what do you guys talk about, sports on those headsets? What are you guys doing with those headsets on? Did they not know where the starting line's at? Because it stays in the same place usually. It doesn't move around much during the race. Anyway, I give them a hard time about it. But it's a level of professionalism. Everybody, I've seen that working, in partnership with DSR last year, about how, having a breakdown of task and having everybody focused on their task just takes execution to a whole nother level. So it makes it very tough for a guy like me, as we were just discussing, with my chassis guy here, about how when things go bad, I got one guy to blame. You know, and I'm up there strapped in thinking, did I put the fuel cap back on? Did I put ice in the thing? You know, if you get these teams that are as very capable as they are competing against you, the guy driving is not thinking about that.
No, their job is just to mash the loud pedal and, you know, do what they need to do.
That's true. But on the other hand, I guess the positive is when I get out of the car, we don't have any debates about what went wrong and who to blame.
Yeah.
It's just look at the data, figure out what happened, what didn't happen, what's going on, and, you know, and what can we do about it before next round.
I like how you call that debates. I've seen some of those debates get very heated very quickly in pits where you just kind of walk away like, okay, I'm just going to let you guys sort this out. I'm going to go away now.
Yeah, it's a different thing. As I was down supporting my partners, as my car's not ready this year yet. Hopefully we'll be very soon as I'm sitting out in front of the shop where we're working on it. You know, as I was down there last, you know, at the beginning of the season at the Gator Nationals in Bradenton with my partners, Carl Tasca and Randy Eakins, were building motors for him, trying to help those guys. I mean, it's a very different thing when you're, you know, talking to the guy who's driving the car and, you know, you did this with a tune-up and after the pass you're asking, what did it do? Did this? And you can look at the data, but, you know, having that firsthand knowledge of what happened when you're in the car, what did you do as a driver? You know, certainly data acquisition systems and being able to look at the data helps a lot. But at one point I told Randy, can you just get out of the car and let me drive it for a minute? I can't understand why it's not doing what it should do. And he let me drive it for about 2 seconds. I said, okay, something is really wrong. We got to figure this out. And anyway, so we figured that out, but it's a tough job. I can tell you, I have great respect for any people who are in these other teams, whether they're the crew chief or one of the guys on the crew, and you know, they have to work in that kind of scenario. So there's pluses and minuses of being a one-man show, but certainly it's taken the level of professionalism way up. I can, you know, Sandy, my wife, who's my crew chief and wasn't able to come to a lot of races, hopefully all of them this year, but her and I were talking about how last winter when I didn't test, I was all ate up about not being able to go out and test. But nobody else really tested last winter. When I showed up in Bradenton, it wasn't unusual that I was the guy there who hadn't really tested. No one else really did. This year, by the time we got to Bradenton, every team in the top echelon had been out testing once, twice, maybe three times. So it's a very different level of play this year.
Yeah, I was going to say that just kind of plays into the escalation of it, that it's gone to a new level where I was very fortunate. I got to tour the Copo facility and see, you know, front to back how those cars were built and talk with them about what goes into these programs. And what I don't think a lot of people realize is what you guys are racing out there, that ain't how it came from the factory. You guys get them and basically say, okay, thanks. And then you tear it apart and you build it, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of rebuilding. And, you know, all the programs come with a different level of race readiness, I think. To varying degrees, they're all, quote-unquote, turnkey cars. I will tell you that this Ford Cobra Jet program, this 50th anniversary car that we're working on finishing up right now for me, that thing was a bad race car from the start. I mean, it just is well put together, well engineered. The Ford team, the Watson Engineering group up there that puts these cars together, it's a serious race car when you get it. Now, if you want to put in stock and super stock and go out and run, you know, 1 second plus under and run low eights all day long and never touch the car, you can do it the way you get it. But if you need that extra 3 or 4 tenths out of it, yeah, you're right. You take it all back apart and you start looking at every nook and cranny of it and, you know, doing this to upgrade that, and everything gets touched.
It's like
ceramic bearings go in place of normal bearings, and, you know, brakes get tweaked to be perfect so they have no drag, and a million little things like that go back in as you take it apart and put it back together to try to squeeze out every hundredth of a second that adds up to that 3 or 4 tenths that, you know, you go from an 820 car to a, you know, 770 car.
It's like they say, ounces equal pounds, right?
Pardon me?
It's like they always say, you know, ounces, you know, you add the ounces pounds.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this one, because of our time frame, unfortunately, we've had 3 weeks to put it together from when we got it from Watson. Thankfully, because of the great work the Ford engineering team has done, and how easy they are to work with, and the availability of all these parts for these Ford teams. I mean, we've been able to pull that off. That's pretty incredible. I mean, and hopefully, here in about 3 days, I'll be starting it up and driving into my trailer.
That's always the, I guess the big moment is when you've put all this work into it, you can finally, start playing with a little bit more. So I imagine you're probably chomping at the bit right now to jump in that thing and start making laps.
Oh, I am. And it's fantastic to have teammates. I mean, that's what I learned in my experience when I went from the Lone Ranger Mopar. I mean, there was nobody in the pits I could talk to about what I was trying to figure out or experiencing. Unlike the Copo guys, you usually had a couple friends I could talk to, or the Cobra Jet guys. I was kind of out there, and when I made a pass and was trying to figure things out, there wasn't anybody else to talk to or compare to. I learned as we got Leah's car running, and then later with DSR campaigning both Leah and Mark's car, that having those other cars, in a friendly, a camp that you can look at data and understand what three cars are doing and how they're reacting is huge in terms of helping you. So obviously I teamed up with Carl Tasca and his team, great people, and great family history. As Carl's dad, the guy who's kind of the founding father of the Cobra Jet, we're out there in honor of him trying to win one for the Cobra Jets this year. And we really, I know it sounds a little too altruistic, but we really don't care what Cobra Jet wins as long as Cobra Jets win every race. So that's our goal this year. And it'd be nice if Carl and I were driving one of them, or Randy Eakins. We're building motors for Randy Eakins' car too. And I was down there, obviously working with those guys all those first two races, trying to help them do well. And we had a pretty good first outing for both cars. So I'm hopeful with all that data, when I get in my make first pass, I got some basis of knowing how to make one of these work. But it's a new car, it's a different car. It's always nerve-wracking. I don't think I've slept this little in the last 5 years since I quit doing my big corporate job. So.
I don't think that's another thing people don't realize. When you have a higher level, car, when you're bringing it out for the first time, the new car blues are just, there's so much that's running through your mind. And I've been on the part of it, with helping Ray Litz when we rolled out his car after it was built and, wrecked it, then rebuilt it, that you're going through as a crew person, let alone the driver, everything, what did I do here? What did I do there? What's it going to do? And then, you're just hoping, there's going to be problems. You're just hoping that they're little problems and not big, scary problems, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And and all the people I work with on this program are the best as far as I'm concerned, from the engine guy to the chassis guy to the drivetrain guy. But I'm used to tightening every bolt myself. And when you build a new car and you get all that help building it for the first time, I mean, this car's going together, and I'm not going to have time to take it home and go through every ounce of it myself. By the time I was done with the Blackbird, there wasn't much left of the original work. I mean, it had been a part and back together, I don't know, 50 times, 100 times between, when I got it from Mike the first time to when it ran the seven. This car will be the first time down the track, and a lot of the bolts in it, if somebody else didn't tighten them, I'm sitting on that. So, but they're fantastic people. You put your faith in them, and you pick great people to work with. And really, when I reflect on, somebody asked me the day, why would you spend this much time and money doing something like this? Of course, one answer is if you got to ask people why they climb Mount Everest, you're never really going to understand why. But the real answer is because I get to hang out with these cool people. I get to work with these cool teams of people, like Tony and his shop full of guys at BBS, and Mike Roth and the guys here. We're working together building this car, and Jason Cohen and these guys. I mean, it's just so much fun working with all these talented, passionate people that have an objective they're working together to accomplish. And given that I gave up my corporate big job a while back, I really miss some of that. So a lot of that's why I do it. And then of course you have the track and the camaraderie, and my wife's there, and the camaraderie of my family and friends at the track. That's really why we do it. But it isn't cheap and it isn't easy.
Yeah,
There's no doubt about that.
it's racing is not, a hobby that if you don't have the ability to rebuild what you blow up, it's not something you want to step into. It's time consuming, and people think that we're absolutely insane because we spend wheelbarrows of cash to go as quickly as we can possible down the track. You explain that to drag racing people, they just look at you like, "Why are you doing that again?" You just got to, if I can't explain it, you got to do it.
Yeah, you do. And this is just such a complicated puzzle. These cars are so ragged edge. I mean, I know there's lots of cars, X275, and a lot of the cars that run today that make these cars look slow. And rightfully so, they deserve the respect they get. That Sweet 16 race down there was fantastic. But the bottom line is, with these cars, because the limitations on chassis changes and 9-inch tires and all the factory componentry that is still the base, especially in this Ford program. I mean, it's incredible how much of that Ford parts are part of these cars that came directly from Ford. And you're making all that stuff work, and you have all these knobs to turn, within that constrained world, you still have all kinds of things you can adjust, shocks and spring rates and settings of things between rounds, and you have two onboard data acquisition systems that dump literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of channels of data in front of you that you can analyze and try to figure out what to do next. And then you got to load the thing back up, pack it, shoot up, and get ready for the next launch in 45 minutes and make all the right choices. There's nothing quite like that. I mean, it's just awesome.
Oh,
And
it.
I'm incredibly blessed to be part of it. I can't tell you how lucky I feel that I get to do this.
It's interesting you talk about that with comparing it to heads up racing, and they're both animals. They're just slightly different species of animals. They're both still the same vicious animal. It's just with these cars, it's like they're little baby power added pro stockers almost. They're finicky. You got a lot of rules, and if you don't hit everything right, they ain't gonna do what you want it to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And your choices, transfer weight and stand them on the bumper and put them up on one slick, which is not a good fun ride when it comes back down. Or go up and smoke, and then in between is carry the wheels. I mean, these cars can carry the wheels 100 feet out there, and then when you put them back down, you got to get back to the black stuff pretty quick when you make that 1-2 shift. Because if you're not sitting on top of rubber when you make that shift, or the 2-3 down track on those little tires with that much power, bad things happen quick, as you've seen.
Oh, it gets dicey real quick.
Yeah, they turn. I drove super stock Hemi car, ran low eights, and it's just a very different experience running a car with that much tire under it versus these cars. When these cars break loose down track, they turn left, right now. I mean, it's not. I mean, your reaction as a driver. I don't know. You said you saw my car in Joliet. I don't know if you were there when I hit the wall in Joliet, because I did. But your reaction as a driver to correct has to be so aggressive in these cars, and you better aggressively react, or you're going to end up in bad shape. And even if you do aggressively react, as you see, if there's any moisture under the tires or any downtrack slickness in those gear changes, especially, you're going to have a handful. So they're a blast to drive. I got the planets aligned for me. I plan to run super stock and stay over there and watch the circus going on over here in the factory shootout wars. And somehow, all the people poking and prodding me in the pits, telling me I couldn't make these Mopars work, finally pushed me over the edge. And it's just incredible how all the pieces aligned, and I'm here today talking to you about running a Ford Cobra Jet and helping try to lead the charge to keep those guys and put them in front. So it's been a wild ride. I've been drag racing since I was 13 years old. I'm a little over 55 today, so I've been at this for a while, and I just never would have imagined at this point in my career I'd get the opportunity to do what I'm doing now. So.
What are you looking forward to now with, like you said, you're in the Cobra Jet now, and that was a pretty big off-season announcement. When I heard that pop up, I was like, oh, people are gonna get shook over that. And then you've made this jump to the Ford family. What's that kind of been like for you?
Well, I have to tell you, it's not to say anything derogatory about the folks at DSR and the folks that I was able to work with, the younger engineers, many of them which have moved on in the SRT program. Originally, when I started helping the SRT engineers, there was no DSR. It was a couple, three young engineers trying to make this car that Leah had work for her, and I helped them make it work for her, and in turn work on our program together. And that transformed into DSR taking over leadership of the program and taking over the program, and that kind of was that path. And but working with the Ford guys, very refreshing in many, many ways. One, I like new challenges. I always, if you look at my life and the choices I've made throughout it, that's kind of the backbone of I get bored pretty quick with once I figure something out. I don't really want to sit around and enjoy the fruits of my labor much. I want to go find the next hill to climb. So that's certainly a big part of why I'm enjoying this so much. It's a very different car, very different engine, very different set of challenges. Secondly, I love working with great people. And, you know, as I got to know Carl Task and his team, I mean, we pitted by each other a lot, and they were incredibly helpful last year with my family situation, my wife's health situation. I was at the races a lot by myself, and they were just incredibly supportive and helpful, as were many of my competitors. But they were especially so. And so they're great people. And then as I got to know the Ford engineering team, as a guy who started my career as an engineer a long, long time ago, I got a lot of respect and empathy, I guess, for being a guy in a big corporation trying to make things like this happen. And just an incredible group of people at the Ford engineering, from Mark Wilson. So yeah, Mike Delahanning, you know, a great guy, comes to the track, goes to all the Ford Cobra Jet teams, make sure everybody's getting help. Dave Bourne, engineer, Andy Rinko, Ron Eric, these guys on the Ford Cobra Jet program, just top-notch guys, top-notch engineers, top-notch guys, lots of experience through their careers on lots of, you know, mainstream car programs, and they're fully vested and aligned to make these Cobra Jets the badass race cars they are, and they are truly that way when you get them. So that's great, great products, great people, and great new challenge. A little hard for me to resist all that, and, you know, and I like the aspect of, you know, the underdog, you know, kind of the Carl Tasca. Obviously, he's from a famous family, but he tows his car to the track in a pickup with a pickup truck and a tow-behind trailer just like I do. These aren't, you know, Randy Eakins, same kind of deal as me. He's got a living quarters gooseneck he's had for 20 years and a pickup truck, and we tow our cars to the track. So it's kind of fun being the Davies in this becoming Goliath sport and trying to out there compete as the Davies. So it's been a great experience so far, and like I said, I'm really looking forward to being in the driver's seat of one of these cars. But fantastic people and fantastic products, and I'm looking forward to trying to keep them in front all year.
So going off of that, with, you know, now we've had a chance to see these cars on the track in the NMCA, the first Gator National race, and all the testing, what do you see happening in this class this year? Do you think it's just going to be an absolute knockdown, drag out fight with the changes now that the NHRA is kind of mandated to these cars, bringing parity? And I mean, what's your gut tell you based on your experience class racing on where this is going to end up, you know, when it all settles at the finals?
Well, I think the thing that you first have to realize as you get into this and you see the level of play this has moved to, that, you know, my all those years running stock, super stock, and being a bracket racer for many years before I ran stock and super stock, this is very different. There's a lot of influences at play in how this is going to play out over the next year. I mean, there's people who are, you know, who do this to make a living. There's people who made a great amount of wealth and demonstrated that ability to generate wealth elsewhere and are using their wealth in this. I mean, there's all kinds of dynamics playing out that are quite honestly very different than, I'll call it, stock, super stock. And in terms of manufacturers who have a skin in the game, the sanctioning bodies who obviously want to keep this interesting and keep the momentum, and the different teams who have various levels of connection and influence with NHRA. That's all very different than, you know, there's not too many DSR sponsored cars in Stock Eliminator or in Skillman. You know, obviously great team, great capability, grew up as a sportsman racer. But, you know, they're pro-level team running this stuff. So, I mean, and he's one of many. So it's just a very different dynamic, and the influences are such that it's going to be kind of hard to say how all these rule changes that are being driven by all those influences are going to play out on the track. I can tell you that the adjustment was surprisingly large for a first adjustment right after the first race. But hey, you know, we don't make the rules. We play in the playground. So we're going to go to work and do the best we can within the rules that the rule makers make, and do the best we can. I can tell you, having been around this and the level of play that this is at, that I like that I get to do it. I'm incredibly blessed to do it. I can tell you, I wouldn't want to be a full-time crew chief or a full-time crew member of one of the special teams, given what I just told you about, all the back and forth that happens when you divide up the work. Although there's a lot of positive of it. I can tell you the least job I'd like to have would be the rulemakers.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
The sanctioning bodies. I mean, it's a thankless job. They're doing the best they can. It's incredible that you have these cars that have such differentiation, and I think that's the root of it. I don't think parity is the answer. I mean, I view parity to the level of all these cars run within a hundredth of a second. They all have exactly the same formula engine, exactly the same aerodynamics, exactly the same cross-sectional area. I don't think that's what this is about. I'm not saying that there's other classes where that doesn't work really well. I just don't think that's what makes this class tick. So I'm hopeful that we don't get into the boring planes of over parity. On the other hand, everybody's got to have a chance to win. You know, the Mopar guys, I want them every bit as much as I did last year to be competitive. I want the Chevy guys to be competitive. I want the Ford guy. I want it dicing up. Anybody can win a race, and they're all out there fighting hard to win it. So I understand the rulemakers have to do what they do, and they made some choices, and we're gonna do that. The NMCA hasn't followed suit yet. The next race for them is coming up very quick. Some of these parts and time it takes to reoptimize the car is such that maybe they'll, I don't know for sure what they're going to do, but maybe they'll wait till the race after. I don't know what they're going to do. So, there are two sanctioning bodies, and NMCA, having raced there and really enjoyed racing there, and they're great races, I see them on the equal stage of how important they are to these cars in this class. So I think it's going to be an interesting set of scenarios that plays out here, a lot of dynamics at play. Hopefully we'll give fans of all three brands something to cheer about all year long, and we'll be out there slugging it out, and I fully expect it to be nothing but blood, sweat, and tears to stay in front in this class with all that going on. So I wouldn't bet $10,000 on any outcome at this point. I mean, I don't know. Randy Eakins could be the world champion this year just as likely as Leah Pritchard could be. I don't know.
And I think that's, what makes it this class just so awesome right now is the winners are going to be the fans ultimately, because they just get to see this insanity unfold. The rules makers are probably going to lose a couple years of their life trying to figure out how to make all this work. And the racers are just already probably looking at their pocketbooks, apologizing softly because they're going to take a pounding. But I think that all just kind of, it all ties together the energy of this class, because like you said, it's manufacturer against manufacturer. You got all kinds of personalities. And I mean, it's literally like an old school throwback to like match racing pro stock when you had Grumpy against the world and everything else. It's just like that, but with fuel injection and blowers.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I keep pinching myself. Like, is this really happening? One, if I were watching it happen and still running my car over in super stock or wherever I was running it, my brother runs Stock Eliminator, and hanging out the track with him, or bracket racing on a Saturday night at some track. If I was just watching this happen from a distance, it's almost unbelievable it's actually happening. I mean, I just can't believe how cool this is. And then to be lucky enough or blessed enough to be part of it, that's just like over the top. I mean, I saw, I said I started racing when I was 13 years old. I went to this local Assumption, Illinois dragster at Motion Raceway, and then my brother was crewing on his 66 Pontiac Tempest that we drug down there on a tow bar behind an old pickup truck we bought, and raced it every weekend in the bracket races down there when bracket racing was just starting out back in the late 70s. And the class racers would show up, and they were like the rich guys that, kind of all their cars always looked pretty and they were perfect, and and they'd come and show up and test. And Maldoni and Gartless would book in a match race, or Grumpy and somebody would book in a match race, and we'd stand at the fence and watch them go down this track on some late summer's evening. And just to see all that history and to now see it kind of repeating itself in a new age way with these fuel injected, blown cars. This Cobra Jet Mustang is very close akin to that GT500 that's just rolling out, the baddest of bad Mustangs. It's got a supercharged Coyote in it. It's got a supercharged Coyote. Obviously, the Dodges and Chevy, same kind of deal. And so these cars are not completely crazy different from what you drive on the street. In fact, they're very close to it. The GT500 is a Coyote
Lone Coyote and the same Mustang I'm driving. And it's just incredible how cool this is and how it's all playing out. And I just can't. When I was a kid down there, I was standing there, and there's these guys that I thought were old guys racing. First, they were probably like, you know, 20 years, 25 years old, 30 years old, but they were old guys to me. I was walking through the Gator Nationals pits. I went over to see my buddies to Mopar pit, and they were over out of the way, and I walked by these two guys I've raced with for years, Larry Bernhausen and Dave Dahlem. And I remember watching them race when I was 13, 14 years old, and they saw me, and I walked over and talked to them, and you know, they're gray-haired guys in their 60s, 70s now, running Super Comp and Super. And they're like, you know, this is crazy. This is happening with you, Jeff. I mean, we've known you your whole life, and in the last 2 or 3 years, your racing life has changed more than it has in the last 40. You've been racing cars for 40 years. I said, yeah, you know, the point, you know, opportunity knocks, you know, and the opportunity bus rolls up and opens the door. You can either not get on the bus or you can jump through the door, and we jump through. So we're here for another year at least, you know, hanging in there as a Davy in the Goliath, what's becoming a Goliath class, and having a blast doing it. So hopefully we can keep on the ride for a while longer.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, our time here is coming to an end. And like I always like to do with my guests, you know, I like to give them a chance, you know, let everybody know what's going on and what they can expect in the world of Jeff Turk coming up.
Well, hopefully what you can expect is some, you know, some 770 ETs if the rules don't change too much, that we can't do that again. And you'll see an X15, you know, the brother to the SR71 inspired Blackbird will be coming out here, the X15, and Tony Bischoff and Mike Roth and Jason Cohn and all these guys that helped me put this thing together will demonstrate once again that we can make Fords run too, which I think we kind of demonstrated with Tasca and Beacons. But I'm anxious to get behind the seat and prove that these guys' hard work's paying off again and that we can stay in the game, and that's kind of what's coming up. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, and again, I know how lucky I am to be a part of this, and for all the fans out there that are interested or all the other drag racers who've been watching closely and making commentary about it, hey, I'm glad we're all getting to experience this together. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to your listeners.
No problem, man. I appreciate you coming on the show, and looking forward to see the new hot rod out. So make sure you check out what Jeff's got going on with Task and see how all this plays out this year. And thanks again for coming on the show, Jeff.
Thank you, man. Really appreciate it.
All right. My next guest on the Dragzine podcast needs really no introduction. He's $101,000 richer, and he earned it at the Sweet 16, Mr. Kevin Rivenbark. What's up, Kevin?
How you doing?
Thanks for coming on the show. It's interesting to call your rise in the radio world meteoric is being kind of quiet about it, because there were some questions when you first came onto the scene. You're going to be bringing this pro mod to the first event. People didn't know what to expect. And then, you know, I believe it was Churchill said, you know, walk quietly, carry a big stick. And you got a big old stick carry with some pro charger power there, right?
Yes, sure did. I didn't know what to expect either, so that made it interesting.
Yeah, I was going to say, we talked at Lights Out, and it just seemed like that car hit the track, and it was working, and it was doing what it needed to do. You come to the Sweet 16 and were, you know, an odds-on favorite, and then you acted on it. I guess kind of to kick things off here, what did you guys learn at Lights Out that you were able to carry over to the Sweet 16?
Pretty much my driving. I got more comfortable with the car, and, you know, Lights Out, I red lighted in the semifinals of the 006, and that was just my fault. And I feel like just got more comfortable in the car and learn how to drive a little better.
And one thing you kind of mentioned before we talked about, maybe we could expand on a little bit more, is the difference between slicks and radials with, you know, kind of what's that transition been like for you? What was it like going from slicks to radials?
I was nervous at first. Right before Lights Out, we went to Orlando to test on them. And of course they backed it way down for me because I didn't know what to expect. And one thing that everybody kept telling me was, you know, don't get back into it. Just if it spins or does anything crazy, just get out of it and come back. But now after we ran on them, you know, it's a smooth, solid feel compared to the slicks. The slicks, you can feel them squash, and, you know, there's a lot more mass there. So of course it just feels wobbly compared to what the radials do.
Yeah, that's kind of like, you know, what we've always heard is that slicks feel real kind of like washy is what I've described, you know,
yeah,
always heard to describe
washy,
it.
Good word.
And it just,
I mean, you run maybe 6 pounds in a slick, you run 14 pounds in a radio. So, I mean, that helps a lot too for the radio.
Yeah. And I'm sure it probably feels like do you feel like you're a lot more kind of hooked up with the car?
Yes. But now when and I've been very fortunate and I have not experienced this yet, but when it comes unhooked, it comes unhooked. You know, I think we took the tires off twice down in at Sweet 16 when we were trying to rotate the earth and get a record back. But besides that, I mean, the car's been up under me the whole time. I've never felt it wash out or anything. So, I mean, I've been very fortunate not to feel some of the things the other guys have felt, probably.
Yeah, you've definitely kept the wheels under it, and you haven't had any scary moments quite yet. But I'm sure, in your career, it's not a matter of if, and it's a matter of when, for sure, right?
That's correct.
You know, it's with these cars, they're just, people don't understand how, you know, a pro mod's unruly. A pro mod on radials is even more angry because it's wanting to do everything but what you want it to do, right?
Right. That's true.
Now, kind of, you know, touching on the Sweet 16, you know, let's dive into this a little bit. Walking into the event, you know, getting ready, what were you expecting going into this? Like, you know, from how the event would run to, you know, just kind of the whole feel of it. What were you expecting, and then what was the reality of it?
Well, Lights Out, start off with, it was my very first event. Even, I don't think I've even had ever watched Duck's event before, because, I mean, just, it always seemed chaotic to me. But, the first Lights Out event was a very eye-opening for me, the way his events go in the radio world. And then when we got into Sweet 16, you know, I felt a lot more confident and a lot better going into it.
Well, yeah, you probably had, you know, kind of after that first event, you're able to get a flow and a feel, because it's probably different servicing a radio car to a slick car, let alone going from, you know, roots blowers to, or screw blowers to a centrifugal blower. That's probably
right.
Do you a little bit different there, right?
Yeah, the centrifugal is to me is a lot smoother. From the time you let go of the button to the time you let off of it, just, you know, a roots blower like we ran before is to me is angry all the time. I mean, when you let off the button, you're automatically taking 10 degrees out of it just to keep the tires up under it.
Yeah,
you know, and it's not quite that way with the centrifugal. It don't make the boost at the hit.
I was gonna say, I think that's on the tuning side of things. I think that's what a lot of, you know, fans might not realize is just how, you know, they sound angry and loud, but man, those blowers at that level are just they're a different level on what they want to do and how they want to operate right at the hit.
Right.
So, you know, you probably never did been to an event where you got like 10 qualifiers before. that had to be a little bit. Was that like running a marathon? How do you attack that?
That was. To me, it was like going testing somewhere where you can test 2 or 3 days and just nonstop going out, you know, and trying this and trying that. So to me, that's what it reminded me of.
Now, I know that there was, you know, watching the broadcast and seeing the dragzine coverage, there was a little bit of carnage there for some people. Did you guys have did you have any major carnage, or was it, you know, business as usual ish?
After the only thing we had after round two, they were checking the valves and noticed one of the intake valves, the clearance had closed up, and so they took the head off of it, and the valve had tulip some, so it stretched the valve is what it done, and so luckily they caught it. So I wouldn't say I had carnage. I just preventive maintenance.
Yeah, that's. I would say that after that, you'd probably want to buy a lottery ticket in the racer's lottery.
Yeah.
Some of those poor boys. I mean, it was just, you know,
it was crazy.
Yeah, I think I want to be in the hood scoop business for nitrous guys,
yeah,
and block business for some of those boosted guys, because there's stuff blowing up everywhere.
Yeah. And Laughlin, I went by one time, they had a whole front end off of it, it looked like. So,
well, you know, when you put on as many aerial shows as what they do, that's drag racing shocks aren't meant to take that kind of abuse.
But just Alex and them and Tim Slavens, that them two right there goes to show you. I mean, how well they done it. Lights out and then come to Sweet 16 and have issues, how easy it is to go from one event to another and be a completely different game.
Oh, yeah, totally.
For you,
You know, like you always say, I'd rather be lucky than good, you know.
That's right.
Most definitely. And do you think that that luck kind of played into your ability to do what you guys did this weekend?
I think so. I think we were just very fortunate, you know, everything. We came back with the exact same thing we left with, and it all worked again. So, but I mean, it could easily went the other way around for us also. So, but I just think we were very blessed that it all came together again.
Yeah, and I think that, and you might want to chime in on this too, is, you know, how much of that is a testament to the team that you guys have assembled with your partnerships and what you guys kind of do with that? Does that play a big role with that?
Oh, God, yes, definitely. I mean, I wouldn't attempt to go into a radio race without Steve Petty. So, I mean, with Steve and Proline and Brandon and Chris Foster, I mean, I couldn't ask for a better crew.
I'd say, you know, at that level and what you're trying to do, you guys have to, you know, it's not like a top fuel team where you have literally a person for every position. So I'm guessing with a car like this, it's very important to have a tight-knit team, like sort of like a band that plays really well together, so everybody kind of stays on the same page and keeps the song moving along.
Yeah. Has to mesh together, and I've been fortunate with that. When we went to Bradenton, you know, it first time out with them, and you know, everything went smooth. I mean, it was just instant gel. I mean, I had to catch up. They've been together a while. I mean, of course, all of them's worked at Proline's been together for a while, and I mean, they keep employees for a long time. It seems like they don't have a lot of changeover, so that's a testament right there to the quality of people they have. So all I had to do is my driving catch up to what they're doing.
So does you know, speaking on the driving side and cutting the better reaction times, does that also play into with the radio versus the slick on how hard it hits and how it reacts? Is that how you kind of had to change what you do?
I think that on the radio tires, being that the tires don't squash like a slick, and the suspension grows apart and not squat like you would on a slick, I think there's just no wasted motion on a radio car, that it just, if it's stuck, it's going forward, which is definitely going to give you a better reaction time.
Yeah.
Or a faster reaction time. Then you have to control it.
I was going to wonder if that kind of played into to the red light, just learning to adjust to that.
Yeah, they did it lights out, and, you know, we got fuel tape that runs everything, which is wonderful, but I wasn't even thinking it lights out. It has its own delay box in there. I could have been using the whole time. That's pretty much what helped me at Sweet 16.
Being able to, you know, kind of dial it in as you needed.
Because if you look at, if we took the numbers that I had in the box for delay semifinals again, I would have had a minus 10 light.
Oh, wow.
A red light. And then in the finals, I would have had a 008.
So it definitely takes a little bit of adjustment there.
Yes.
Now, were you guys going into this looking to run, be the first of the 50s, or is that just a byproduct of trying to win the race and just get better?
No, we were definitely shooting for it. We were wanting that.
And what kind of went into your game plan to trying to run that kind of record? Did you guys already know what data you wanted to kind of play with, or was it, you know, something you learned that weekend?
We knew the air conditions was going to be the factor in it, you know, when we could and when we couldn't. But we knew that when we unloaded at lights out and we ran that 66 the first run, if we'd had that 61 package that I ran later in there on the first run, I would have ran the 50s then, because that was the best air there was the whole weekend. So it's pretty much when we came out, we were trying to start out lower than we started last time, which we went a 64 the first run. So we did. We were a lot better. So we just knew it was just going to take the right conditions to make it happen.
So the air conditions really play that much more of a fine line, a fine edge role with these cars being able to run these numbers?
Oh, yes, definitely.
So
I mean, especially on my car, and the Pro Charger is – the air affects it dramatically. I mean, well, if you look at lights out, we started out the very first run at 207 miles an hour. By the end of the event, when it was got hotter, we were at 203 miles per hour.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, the air just, but we sped up, but we made up for it in early numbers, you know, going 9, 17, 60-foot times and stuff like that.
See, that's kind of shocking to me that these, you know, sledgehammer engines are with these big blowers and these power adders, you know, with forced induction, are that finicky, almost like a pro stock car at this level. That kind of surprises me a little bit. I figure there'd be a larger window for you guys there.
Right. You would think so, but it's definitely not for us.
Now, when you ran that 58 going into that qualifying session, you guys had that pretty much planned at that point that you're going to load that big tune-up in and let it eat?
Oh, yeah. Before we even got into cars and staging lanes, I went up to the front of the tower and I had somebody get Donald's attention, and I just rubbed my finger and go, like, give me the money. We're going for it. And then afterwards, I had Lonnie Green, you know, how they had Duck had all the tech guys in referee uniforms.
Yeah.
I had them go up there in front of the tower in front of them and hold up a touchdown sign.
Nice. So you called your shot and then you had him lay that out.
Yeah. Yeah. Only thing we didn't do is dial it in on the window.
Now that would have been an ultimate show of combination of confidence, cockiness, and slap to the face of everybody else. So you call
that's
it
right.
To that level.
That's kind of what we thought.
But you know what? You definitely, you were the favorite to lay something like that, but at the same time, you've gone about it with, I think, a certain level of class and grace, where you knew coming into this that it was, you know, it was going to be a challenge, and then you laid it out there like that. Did you see the 58 pop up on the board, or did you not know until you saw the slip?
I've seen it. I've seen it come on the board. It drove to the left towards the wall, so, I mean, I had to drive it some that run, but so we probably could have went a little lower then, but I won't let it off of it. I knew Wade and him had sprayed the track to the wall, and I was good with it.
So you're just in it to win it. There was no, maybe I should lift it. Was that it? Should be good to go.
Say that again, Brian.
I said, so you had the confidence in the track and the car at that point that you were
yes,
going to stay in it to go.
Definitely.
Now, how did it feel inside the car when you saw that pop up to know that you did something that a lot of people didn't know would ever be possible?
Right. I was more like, wow, we really did it. You know, I mean, it's kind of to the point I felt like we could, but till I actually seen it, I wasn't 100% sure.
That's just it was incredible to watch and hear everybody call it and just see the reaction. It was, you know, last year was like home run derby, and again, it was just like watching the pay-per-view at home. I was glued to it. Like, I set my daily schedule around what was going to be happening and who was up, because I was like, what are these guys going to do next? Literally.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what it seemed like his races are about, you know, it's like next person is up. It's like, what's next? You know, what can they do possibly next to make it better? And it just keeps doing it. So, and it's like Duck said, you know, once one person goes into 50s, next thing you know, you got another person. It's like and just like the nitrous cars. You got one person ran the 60s. Next thing you know, you got two or three that run the mid-60s. And it's just, it does seem like that once that barrier is broken, then it just automatically people just start falling into it.
Now, you've been around the game for a while in a lot of different levels of racing. Do you think that's just kind of, as technologies progress now with data acquisition, that these tuners can just nerd out and dive in there and figure this out a lot quicker?
I think so. I think, you know, the technology definitely has a lot of ways progressed in the last 10 years, for sure. I mean, 10 years ago, we wouldn't have thought about running in the 380s. But I think between the technology and just the knowledge of people and people share. I mean, you know, even though we're competitive, but we still share knowledge here and there. People learn that from other ways or whatever. And it just starts coming naturally.
And I'm wondering this too, with these tuners, you know, like Steve plays with so many different combinations and so many different cars, that cross-pollination between all of these different different combinations and whatnot, do you think that's also kind of fueling this as well?
Yes. I mean, his knowledge on like every I think the only one he hasn't really touched is a Roots Blower. And, you know, every one he's worked with, he's had success with. So he definitely knows power management.
And I think that's what it comes down to with this as well, is it's a matter of power management, because all these cars are making about the same horsepower, give or take, but it's how that they're being applied and what's being used.
That's right. That's right. And the turbos, I feel like, is a lot harder. I mean, just simply because of the way they have to tune them to get them to go, because they just can't. I mean, they've learned a lot, and I think they've helped the early numbers up tremendous, but it's still nothing like what I ran. You know, they don't have the downforces my car's got with the exhaust, and so all of that plays a factor in it.
Now, you went the 58, then Ferris eventually took it with the 57, and you're talking about trying to rotate the earth. Was that part of when you guys started to kick the tires to try to find that combination to go quicker?
Yeah, we were trying it probably when we knew it probably wouldn't be there. The track won't be there for it. So then we finally, that late night session, we waited one session for the night to come, and we ran at 58 with a 2, and we picked up from a, you know, our 58 with a 7 run, we picked up from a 917 to a 913. And picked up one number in 330, but we fell off on the back end. And then that's just a combination of a few things that with air and things that they were making sure that it didn't burn up or nothing. So I think we could have ran the 57 or something if we'd ran a little harder out the back.
And like you said, I think it's a matter of making sure you keep everything happy, because, again, at this level that you're running that hard, you know, it's one degree of timing can spell a difference between a 57 and five holes going melted.
Yes. I mean, that's very important to do.
And on that 57, I do believe Daniel actually cooked that motor to a nice medium well done as well, correct?
Yeah. No, I think they had a lifter break on it.
Oh.
Is what happened on it. But I think the motor they put in there, eventually they would have got, you know, after a few runs with it, got it back where that one was. But the turbos have a hard time in the heat compared to the blowers, nitrous, and my car.
Yeah, just it comes down to all these different power adders have their own pluses and minuses and how they react and how they deal with things.
Right.
Now, with seeing the 57 he laid down, you laid down the 58. What do you think is left in this car? Are you guys still just trying to scratch your heads and figure that out yourselves?
I think we still got a 56 in her. And that's what I was really hoping for. But I think in the right conditions, and I mean, even on slick. So, like, if we get to the World Finals in Virginia and the air is good as it always has, minus 1,100 foot or something like that, you know, then, you know, I don't see where it's not possible.
It's just insane to think about this, because I remember being at Lights Out when, like, 4.0s and people were just losing their minds.
Yeah.
And, you know, here in a short amount of time, we've shaved, you know, five numbers off of that.
Yeah, it's crazy. And we're pro at three numbers now.
And now people are like, well, can they do 40s?
Yeah.
It's a matter of, I don't know if it might be a matter of when and should they, you know, what's going to be the safety cutoff level with these cars? Because it's one of those things we were talking with Leah Pritchett about this, the factory showdown cars, that those cars and the drag packs particularly, they're at their weight limit for their safety regulations. At some point, SFI is going to go, guys, just because you can do it doesn't mean we're going to let you do it.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah, and that's just like the newer cars now and the Pro Mods. I mean, they're coming out of like Jerry Bickle's shop and whoever else's. They're a little heavier because they're making them a little more stiffer because of what we're doing with them now.
Oh, it's nuts to see, what Frankie Taylor did a couple of years ago in Outlaw Trim, and, you know, laid down that ridiculous number in the quarter mile, and they're doing it in HRA. You know, it's getting to the point where there's got to be, I think, a big chassis breakthrough soon,
right,
to figure this out, to go further.
Yeah. And basically, we're going to do it like Top Fuel. We're going to slow down somehow.
Yeah. And drivers hate that. But, you know,
right,
us racers are really bad about our own personal safety because we just want to do stupid things and go fast.
Right.
Because it's fun. And, someone's got to step in and go, yeah, guys, maybe you got to back it off a little bit.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, kind of piggybacking off of that, you know, would you take your car and run it out the back door in a quarter mile setting on radials?
On radials, I think about that. but definitely on slicks here soon, hopefully.
That's surprisingly enough, that's an answer a lot of guys give, that there's a lot of pause to it. They're like, you know, yeah, but no, because I think it was DeMarco told me to be the best. He said, you know, it gets kind of terrifying on these small tires past the eighth mile.
Right.
You know, David Atkins said the same thing when he set the LSX record on radios. He said, you know, you go past the eighth mile mark, these cars start making funny noises that you're not used to hearing them make, and you're just hoping it ends. You know,
after that first eighth mile, you start realizing what's going on.
Yeah, you start having questions and regrets.
Yep, that's right.
Now, let's talk about eliminations. That, you know, you've made this field just this mind-blowing field of bad radial cars. Going into eliminations, what was your guys' mindset on how you were going to attack it? Was it, you know, race day time, or was it, you know, going to try to maybe rotate the earth a little bit? Were you just racing the track and who was next to you?
After that last qualifying session, we definitely went into race mode and backed it down. You know, either we ran, I think, the 62 first round, but we were trying to be very conservative.
And I think that definitely showed in how that you guys were, you know, it was like the theme from Jaws, you know, that the shark is coming. Exactly. That's because you guys were just down Broadway. And again, it adds to the, I've got to watch this factor. It's, you know, what are they going to do this time? How's this going to go? Because there was a lot of upsets in that first round, correct?
Oh my God. Yes. A lot of them. I was amazed at all that went on.
It definitely made for some interesting ladder comparisons, because then, you know, after seeing those upsets, did it ever enter your guys' thoughts that, all right, maybe, you know, we got to really mind our P's and Q's, because there's some other people out here that are taking out these heavy hitters?
Well, I mean, my first round, I mean, I had no idea Stint would run a 65 with that small block Ford motor, you know?
Yeah.
And he was just as surprised as I was when we got down the other end. And, I mean, I could have easily went out that round. I mean, I had a bad light. I hesitated and had a bad light. Just luckily, he had a worse light, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I was easy pickings that first round if somebody had a decent light and ran a decent number.
That definitely makes it interesting when you mention it from that point of view, that you basically – you had to drive around him essentially at that point, right?
When I had a 106 light and he had a 202. So, ooh. I mean, I was ahead of him. But he still ran a 65. So, if he'd had a 50 light or something, you know – I'd been in trouble.
I didn't realize that the lights were that
yeah,
that questionable. Wow, yeah, that would that definitely would have made things interesting for sure.
That's right.
Wow.
So, but I didn't let it happen again after that. I figured that was my only luck round, so I made sure I had anywhere from 60s, 40s to 10s after that.
You took your mulligan, took your took your medicine, and realized, all right, not invincible.
I'm gonna go home the other way this time, but somebody just outrunning me instead of red lighting, so I better get on the tree.
Yeah, and that you did. I mean, you basically, you know, did your job as the driver. The crew did your job. You marched through. Now you come into the finals against someone that, you know, in Bryson, that no one thought he was gonna make it.
Right.
And you know, it's a nitrous car. You've seen them run really well, you know, in the 60s. So, you know, that's, you know, he might not have done it, but you know, the potential's there. How did that change at all what you guys were going to do in the finals, or was it just business as usual?
It was business as usual as far as the car performance. But, you know, to me, it could have went a few different ways, you know. I mean, he could have went down and I'd relax on the light like I did with Stinton, and him surprise you with a run and put you out, or you know, or I could have red lighted, you know. So it's a fine line of what you do, you know. So like I said I had that 10 in semifinals, which was really a minus 10 because of what we had in the box, and me and Petty talked about it, and I said, let's roll a few more in there. I mean, at least I can, if I have a decent 30-40 light, I'm gonna be tough to beat, and if he beats me, then he deserves it.
So you guys were rolling in there prepared that, you know.
Right.
We already dodged one bullet. Let's make sure that
We definitely won't take them lightly.
Especially when there's, you know, six figures of cash money laying on there.
Definitely.
So, you know, it didn't turn out to be much of a race as anticipated, because, you know, he swung for the fences and, you know, you missed, and you went just directly down Broadway. It looked like
looked like
you know, just a bracket racer running his 990 number. Did you look over at all, or were you just concentrating on making sure that kept it between the pipes and did what you got to do?
Well, no, I looked to see if I seen him anywhere, and I never once seen him. So I figured if he didn't have me by half track, he won't get me.
And, you know, with that said, and then you see that light up with the W, what's it like to sit inside a race car and know you just won $101,000?
I needed oxygen down the other end. I did. I was like, oh, my Lord. I was like at a point where, like, I'm glad it's over with.
Yeah, because I'm sure it's fun.
It's
yet
like nail biting.
It's fun, but stressful, I'm sure, at that level.
Yes.
And you know,
especially when you know you got a car that's capable of winning, and then you screw it up or something. I mean, it puts a lot of pressure on you as a driver to make sure you're not the one that messes up. When you look at you and like, God, you had a perfect car, and you screwed it up. So, I mean, it puts a lot of pressure on you.
When you're getting ready for the, you know, $101,000 race, you know, it's literally at that point, it's like a big money grudge race. Are you just thinking about what you got to do, or do you try to block all the extra noise and the pressure out of your mind?
Yeah, I've never been affected by that. That or what somebody else is doing over there trying to play games on the trees. I've never really been affected by that. I mean, I'm going to race my side, and they can sit there and wait as long as they want to, or go in early, whatever they want to, or fans or whatever. Some reason that has never really affected me.
Yeah, that was interesting, because, you know, different people have different ways of attacking races. Some racers like to just be absolutely amped up, scream and yell on edge. Other people are, you know, cool as a cucumber. And everybody reacts to the situations in different ways. That's, you know, from my own personal experience, when NHRA did their Unleashed tour, they ran here in Columbus, and somehow I found myself in the quarterfinals. And I'm like, all right, cool. You know, hey, just got to go out here and, you know, keep running this deal. And I remember pulling around the corner at Trails, and all of a sudden there's all these TV lights up. And that was the first thing that caught me. I'm like, man, that's a lot of lights. You know, all right. And then the next thing I know, there's like a TV camera in my window pointed at me. And that took me out of my game slightly. I'm like, all right, this is different. This is new. And I think that
is,
you know,
real.
yeah, it definitely changed things real quick. And, you know, I from that point forward, I kind of have been able to learn in my own racing experience, and tying it to what you said there, is you got to stay on your own game in your own lane and not let the other stuff affect you,
right?
Because it will affect you, whether it's on the tree or anything else. And that's, you know, that can be a big issue. Now you've locked all this up, you've done this, you know, I'll always like to ask my guests as we're rounding out their segment, you know, so what's going to be next for Kevin in the Galat car? What do you guys got going on now?
Well, we carried the car back to Proline and changed it back over to big tires, and we'll bring both of them out to Galat to PDRA opener.
Oh, right on. Yeah, that's coming up here real soon.
Yeah, next week.
Now, are you just going to leave it on big tires? Are you coming back to radials?
No, we'll leave it on big tires the rest of the year and run all the PDRA races. I think the No Mercy event is on top of the World Finals of PDRA. So, I mean, if I do well and I'm in the points of PDRA for the championship, I'd probably just stay there.
Right on. How wild would that be to win the biggest radial tire race of the year and then you win a PDRA title in the same year?
That'd be great.
I mean, in my opinion, I think that's going to definitely lock you in as probably one of the best drivers around when you have the ability to do both of those things. Because that's like, you know, that's horseshoes and hand grenades right there. Two totally different things. And being able to dominate in both, that's huge.
Right. I agree.
So, you know, you're going to be back on the big tires. Is there anywhere else that fans will be able to catch out on social media, any races? You know, what else you got going on?
If we can make the Street Car Showdown, we will. I just don't know. I think it's going to conflict with some other races that Proline has going on, Sea Petty and all, with the NHRA. But mostly just the PDRA races and our Mad Mules and maybe at Virginia, some of his events at VMP.
Awesome. Well, there you have it, folks. The $101,000 man that, you know, locked it in, had first of the 50s, $101,000 richer, you know, checking those off like it's not just his job. Awesome job, Kevin. Thank you for coming on the show. We appreciate it.
No problem, Brian. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, that wraps up the show for this week. Thanks to Kevin and Jeff for coming on and talking with us about their exploits in the drag racing world. Looking forward to speaking to them maybe more in the future. So, until next time, may your reaction times be crisp and your win lights bright. Till next week, folks.